is for us to finish Perek Ayin, chapter 27. You know, unlike the chapters that take us, you know, 10, 11 weeks, this one is I think more straightforward. It's also a lot shorter. That definitely helps with only 12 sentences. But also I felt like it was important to wrap the chapter this week because after this week we're off until after Sukkot. So definitely need to not, you know, try to come back to the same chapter afterwards. That wouldn't be so healthy. So hopefully we will finish Perek HaZayin. We'll finish chapter 27. This is David's return to the Plishtim, to the Philistines. We talked about last week why David went back there. Why did he feel this would work better than when he first traveled there in chapter 21? I'm not going to go through that right now. Although, at the end, if there's time, we'll have review questions, so we'll get to see it then. But the major point that emerged from our discussion last week, at least to me, is that there are two ways to view David's position here. One way to view it is that David is desperate. He needs to get away from Shaul, and that's what drives him to go to the Philistines as a place where Shaul perhaps doesn't have access, or where Shaul will not fear that David is rallying people against him. And so it's just, I need somewhere safe, and that's why I'm going there. The alternative is that David is coming there with strength. He has 600 men, resources to offer, and David is planning on not only operating there from a position of strength, but also taking advantage of the opportunity to do things that are going to help the Jews, as we're going to see in the rest of the chapter. And here I highlight for you source number one, which is from Ralbag in his summary of lessons to be learned from this book. So yeah, I think I've mentioned before that the lessons for a large swath of Shmuel are actually brought in his commentary to the beginning of Shmuel Bet. So lesson number 43 in his collection, he says, Lahodia Otsem Avas David Amo. This story is meant to show David's great love for the Jews. Kigam be'ez shabarach me'eretz Yisrael. Even when he has to flee from Israel, v'haya be'eretz plishtim, and he's in the land of the plishtim, so he's thinking about saving himself. We're going to see he's fighting wars against the enemies of Israel at the same time. And he's wiping them out. He doesn't keep any of them alive, as we'll see. David's not only operating on one level in terms of what he's doing in his battles, as we're going to see, but he's operating on another level at the same time as he's causing Achish to think that he's actually fighting the Jews. That causes Achish to think that David has turned on the Jews, and therefore to think that David is going to be trustworthy for him. Like we said last week, that's why David wants to be out of the range of Achish's oversight. He wants to be independent, that he can do this. That was all, that was a mixture of what we saw last week and what we're going to be seeing this week. But Ralbag's point, and the reason I bring it here, is that David is desperate. It's not that David is in a good position. David needs to get away from Shaul, and that is a priority. However, he is simultaneously operating from strength and taking opportunities to help the Jews. So you're seeing both elements in David's activity here. Clear? Okay. So that brings us to the second half of this chapter. Sentences 7 to 12. Pasuk Zion. I'm just going to turn to it in my own. Okay. Vayihi mispar hayamim asher yashav David b'stei filishtim yamim v'arba'a chodoshim. So, in general, what we're going to section is David pulling a fast one on Achish. in line with the plan we've already talked about in terms of attacking those who are around. But we're going to have to understand David's behavior in this chapter, exactly what he's doing, why he's doing it, to whom he's doing it. But before we get to that, we have a timeline problem. This sentence says, the length of time that David was in the field of the Plishtim, field because we said he moved to Tziklag, which was Ir HaSadeh, as opposed to a walled city, it's a field city. Yamim V'arba'a Chodoshim. Tell me something. Anyone have a translation in front of them? Can you tell me what it says?
Mine clearly changes Yamim to Yamayim. It says 4 months and 2 days.
4 months and 2 days. That's, well, I don't know if they're changing it to Yomayim or they're saying the minimum plural is two.
Oh, okay.
But either way, 4 months and 2 days is one way to read it. Etty, is that what you have?
No, mine says that he dwelt in the country of the Philistines for a full year and 4 months.
A full year and 4 months. So that's a very different read. I just enabled transcript, because not everyone can hear so well. Two notes. Number one, if the transcript is annoying to you, you can turn it off. There are options for doing so. Just look at your controls under more or under live transcript or whatever, and you can turn off subtitles. But on the other end, if you really enjoy it and want to be able to review it later, if you click on live transcript, you can choose view full transcript, and there should even be an option to save the transcript. So you can watch the greatest hits of Zoom's attempt to transcribe Hebrew. Good luck. Okay.
Is the transcript the same sheet as you give us?
No. Transcript means as we're talking, it's showing you words. You're not seeing that on your screen?
No. Just see you and everybody else. I
see chat. You see chat, and then share screen, record, and then live chat.
No. But it's wait a second. Is it not showing for Vanessa? You don't see it. Wait a minute.
Okay, I see it. I have
it
right away. I thought.
Oh, okay.
I have the thing that says.
Okay. I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about the transcript. If you don't see it and you don't want it, then you're in good shape.
You need to scroll all the way down.
Okay. Linda, you were gonna say.
My interpretation says, in brackets, some days and 4 months.
Right, and in the chat also, Leah noted, some days and 4 months, she has the Judaic Press. I don't know if that's what you have also. So some days and 4 months is, you know, where Jeanette is saying 2 days, because Yamim minimum is two, they're saying some days and 4 months. But the fundamental debate is whether to take the word Yom as day or as year. That's really what this comes down to. We know that in the Chumash, the word Yom usually means day. But Yamim, on the other hand, can mean the plural days, but it could also mean year. So examples of that, the most famous example, I think, is when Rivka's family suddenly doesn't want her to go with Avram's servant to go to Yitzchak, and they say, let her stay with us, Yamim O Asor, which is a very strange thing to say. Days or ten. What does that mean? In Rashi, there are comments that Yamim there means year, and they're saying a year. If not a year, then 10 months. But there are a lot of examples of it in the Chumash. It talks about the Jews camping in the wilderness, and it says, O Yomayim, O Chodesh, O Yamim, for 2 days, or for a month, or for a year. Or Vaneshev b'Mitzrayim Yamim Rabim, we sat in Egypt not many days, but many years. Avraham passes away, Zakein Usiva Yamim, elderly and filled with years, not filled with days. Yeah, Yamim can frequently mean year or years. So what does it mean here? Is it that David is with the Plishtim for a year and 4 days, 2 years and 4 days? A year and 4 months, 2 years and 4 months, 4 months and a day or two? Based on the text itself, what would you say? Just from the text, not from any greater knowledge of our story, just from the verse itself, what would you say? Yeah, Linda.
I would say 2 years. 4 months and a few days.
You would have said 4 months and a few days. Does everybody agree?
Yep.
So I have a problem with that, and I'm not the only one. I think it's Abarbanel who also points it out. The order is wrong. Normally, when you want to say months and days, you put the months first. Yamim v'arba'a chodashim, days and 4 months, is an unusual way to frame it. So there are two views in the commentators. There's the short view and the long view. The short view is 4 months and a few days. That's Rashi's view, that's Radak's view, and there are two basic pieces of evidence to support that. First of all, Rashi quotes you the Medrash in Seder Olam. If you take a look at source number 3, I'm skipping number 2, but it's going to matter, we're just not ready for it yet. But take a look at source number 3, the Medrash that Rashi quotes. He says, Kol yamav shel Shmuel haro'eh einan ela nun beis ve'od. Shmuel lived to be 52 years and change. Shneamar, as the pasuk says, Ve'eli ha'kohen yoshev al kisei v'hi maras nefesh. I'm going to explain this outside of the text. Remember that when Chana goes to the Mishkan for the first time to pray for a child, so we're told that Eli was sitting on the chair, right? If you remember this whole story, Eli is sitting on the chair. We talked about it back when we learned the beginning of Shmuel, the idea that it was the chair of the Shofet. Eli had been appointed Shofet that day. Eli would be a Shofet, we know, for 40 years. So Eli is, assuming Shmuel lives to be only 52 years and change, that's already 39 years out of Shmuel's life. Because that's the time she prays for a child. Then she has a child, right? A year later, we're told. So that means that by the time Eli is done being a Shofet, there are 13 years left in the life of Shmuel. And Shmuel dies 4 months before Shaul dies. So the rest of the Medrash isn't necessary for us right now. It will be relevant, but it's not relevant right now. The key point is this line in the Medrash that says that Shmuel dies 4 months before Shaul dies. Well, do your math, right? Shmuel's already been dead since the beginning of the story with Naval, right? So that means, and we know that David is not going to remain with the Plishtim after Shaul dies, as you'll see in the beginning of Shmuel Beis. So this can't possibly be a year. Now, that's the idea. Just to give a little bit more of the background on this whole chronology that Seder Olam is giving. When we did chapter 7, we went through this in depth. Some of you may still, be traumatized by the math. But if you flip back for a second to chapter 7, remember that the Jews went to war against the Plishtim, against the Philistines. This is long before Shaul is on the scene. The Jews go to war against the Philistines. They lose the Aron. They lose the Ark. Eventually, the Ark comes back. And then you see chapter 7, sentence 2, we are told that from the time that the ark stayed in the town of Kiryat Yearim, 20 years passed. And then we're told that Shmuel holds a major gathering of the Jews and they declare they have repented and so on. So the Aron is in a place called Kiryat Yearim for 20 years. Got that? The Gemara tells us in source number 4 that those 20 years last until the time that David moves the Aron to Yerushalayim. So the entire span of time from when the Aron was returned and started in Kiryat Yearim until David moves it to Jerusalem is 20 years. Now, as source number 4 from the Gemara in Zvachim, the Aron moves to Yerushalayim 7 years into David's reign, which means you only have 13 years from the time that the Aron returned until Shaul's death. And what the Gemara does is it says Shaul's reign was actually very, very brief. Shaul's reign is just a couple of years. in order to fit everything into this sandwich period, and I realize that this is maybe a little bit difficult for people who aren't, like, you know, thinking about the whole chronology of the book. I'm trying to figure out how much background we really need to give. But the reason I'm bringing you the Medrash number 3 and the Gemara number 4 is to show you that the Medrash and the Gemara believe that Shaul is not a king for a very long time. And therefore, we have to assume that that the period that David is with the Plishtim has to be short. So it's 4 months and a couple of days. That's it. Now, I should note, when Seder Olam says there are 4 months between Shmuel's death and Shaul's death, it's actually based on our verse. It's a tautology. It's because our verse says 4 months. So you can't really bring proof from Seder Olam that it's 4 months. It's just Seder Olam read our verse to mean 4 months, you know? So that's not a great proof. But this is, in general, the view of the Midrash, that it means 4 months. That's the view. Radak actually believes it's 7 months between the death of Shmuel and then the death of Shaul. And he agrees with the fundamental point that the time frame is way too short, and he adds a piece of evidence to support the idea that Shaul is king for a very brief period of time. Some of you were there when we learned this. Go back to chapter 13, sentence 1. Chapter 13, sentence 1 is after Shmuel gives his retirement speech. It then says, Ben Shana Shaul b'molcho, which we understand to mean Shaul was 1 year into his reign. He's not a year old. Ushte Shanim Malach al Yisrael, and he reigned for 2 years. So Radak says, if he only reigned for 2 years, right? Shaul is only king for 2 years. And you're going to take out a year and 4 months for when David is with the Plishtim, that means you have only had 8 months for everything that happened from the time that Shmuel anointed David back in chapter 9. Anointed Shaul, I should say, back in chapter 9. So Shaul's, you know, initial war with the Plishtim and Yehonasan and the whole business about eating and the fast that the soldiers were supposed to be fasting, that whole story that we had back in chapters 13 and 14, the war against Amalek in chapter 15, the anointing of David in 16 and Shaul beginning his Rach Ra'ah, the fight of David and Goliath in chapter 17, right? You're sandwiching in an awful lot. Plus, add into that, the time that David is a fugitive, and Shaul goes after him in Keilah, and Shaul goes after him in Zif, and then David is helping Naval and his men in Midbar Paran, the whole thing with Abigail. Like, you're going to really cram all of that into an 8-month period? I mean, that's not realistic. So Radak says that's another reason to say that this had to be a short time. It's 4 months and a couple of days that David is there among the Plishtim. Otherwise, the chronology just doesn't work. I will note, Ralbag and Abarbanel think that Radak is misreading chapter 13, sentence 1. They say what that sentence means is that Shaul took 1 year for the people to accept him as king, and he was king for 2 years until the events of chapter 13. They believe that Shaul is king a lot longer. So they're not going to buy that. But that's one view. It's 4 months and a few days, and that is the main Midrashic view. Abarbanel does not like it. First of all, as we said, it shouldn't say days and 4 months. That's weird. You put the larger time frame first. That's number one. Malbim has an answer. He says it's the days when David was in Gath with Achish and then the months after he left Achish to be in Ziklag. So he has another way to read it. Fine. But he also has another problem. Jump ahead now to chapter 29, sentence 3. In chapter 29, sentence 3, Ricky, that's part of the question. That's exactly what we don't know. In chapter 29, sentence 3, the Philistine officers say to Achish, what are these Jews doing with us? Why do we have David and his men with us? We're going to war. And Achish says to the Philistine officers, this is David, servant of Saul, king of Israel, who has been with me, yamim ozeh shanim. Days, if we take him as days, or some years. So it sounds like it's a longer period of time. Granted, Radak says what he's saying is, he's been with me for days and it feels like I've known him for years. That's the way that Radak reads it. But the bottom line is that Barbanel says, I don't think you're right. I don't think that this is correct, that this was a short period of time. And he takes the long view. He says, Shaul did not reign for 2 years. Ricky posted a message asking, how long was he king? Right? And we saw that the Medrash believes that he was only king for 2 years. Abarbanel disagreed. Abarbanel said those 20 years that the Aron was in Kiryat Yearim are not until David moves it to Jerusalem. It's until the Jews did tshuva, until the Jews repented, during Shmuel's time, before Shaul is ever king. Those 20 years are not encapsulating this long period of time. It's just not so. Shaul was king for much longer. Shmuel lived for more than 52 years, according to Abarbanel. He does not die at the age of 52. And so he believes it's a year and a few days. Lest somebody say, who cares, Torchina? Right? It's 4 months and a few days. It's a year and 4 months. Like, why does this matter? Actually, Abarbanel, I think, believes it's 2 years and 4 months. He's even better. But I think that the reason it matters is just in terms of our question of how much time David is with the Philistines and they come to trust him. Like, was it a short period and they just trusted him right away? Was this a long time? And they really felt like, okay, he's on our side because he had established a track record with them. And we have both views. Yes, Etty.
I believe that it was a long time because he just, whatever, a year ago or whatever, destroyed Goliath and they chased the Philistines and they killed a whole bunch of them and whatever. So in order for them to trust him again, he would have had to be with them for a while.
It's a reasonable argument. It's a reasonable argument. Sandy points out, we're about to read in the next lines in the chapter, about David fighting battles against three different tribes. Like, did you do that in 4 months? Today we'll line up this one, tomorrow we'll line up that one, the next day we'll line up that one. Like, how in the world did you pull that off, David? A legitimate question as well. I hear the arguments, for sure.
I also feel that Shaul reigned more than 2 years, because when he was anointed, he was young still. Like, his father sent him to look for donkeys. He wasn't like anybody important yet.
So he wasn't.
And then he has daughters that are marriageable.
So he wasn't that young when he became king, because he already had sons who were of military age. Shaul. Yeah, he already has Yonatan.
Or was it later on in Israel?
No, because remember the story right after he is anointed originally by Shaul, after that original thing, the Jews say, forget it, and then the Philistines attack, and he has Yonatan with him at that stage for the battle. And that's right. That's even before he has been accepted as king. That's right away, it seems. So he's older. You're right that he's not like some big shot, but he's old enough that he has adult kids. Okay, so let's see where this goes. All of that was really like introductory note. That's not the meat of what we have to deal with here. So take a look. We're back in chapter 27. And we're in sentence 8. Vayal David va'anashav. David and his men ascended. Vayivshetu el ha-gishuri, v'ha-gizri, v'ha-amaleki. They attack the Geshuri, the people of Geshur. I want to talk about who they are later, because there's something to say about Geshur, but I'm just not ready yet. Also, it's written Grizi, but it's pronounced Gizri. So it could be the people from Har Grizim, as they note in the Dat Mikra edition. We know that there was a nation called the Grizi, or it could be people from the town of Gezer, which was a major, a major city there. We know about Gezer from other texts. And Amalek, look who's back. Ki hine yoshavos ha'aretz asher me'olam. They were long-time residents of this land, Bo'acha Shura v'ad Eretz Mitzrayim, all the way to the place called Shur and Egypt. You may remember Shur when we had Shaul's war against Amalek. Mechavila Bo'acha Shur. It's an area down near Egypt. So David is attacking these tribes, and not only is he attacking them, sentence 9, V'hikad David es ha'aretz. David struck the land. V'lo yichaya ish v'isha. He did not keep man or woman alive. V'lakach tzonu v'akar. He takes sheep and cattle, v'chamorim u'gmalim, donkeys, camels, u'begadim, and clothes. Vayashav vayavo el Achish, and he would come back to Achish. Look, Achish, here are some spoils from my war. I'm watching the transcript. It has no idea what to make of any of this. Okay. Vayomer Achish, and Achish said to him in Pasuk Yud, sentence 10, Al pshatetem hayom. Where did you go today? Where did you attack? Vayomer David, and David says to him, Al Negev Yehuda, the south of Judea. Ve'al Negev ha'yirach me'eli, in the south of the Yirach me'eli, Yirach me'el, we're talking here about, it's going to show up again in chapter 30, is from the tribe of Yehuda. Ve'al Negev ha'keni, as well as the south of the Keni. Remember that the Keni were allies of ours. Go all the way back to the story of Devorah in Shoftim and back to Yisro. V'ish v'isha lo yechaye David lahavi gas lemor ben yagidu aleinu lemor kawasa David v'chomish fato kolayemim asher yashav b'stei felishtim. David will not keep man or woman alive to bring to Gat, lest they say, David attacked us. We're not Jews. He didn't want anybody to be able to tell the truth. Last sentence in the chapter. Vayamein Achish b'David lemor hav'eshiv ish b'amo b'Yisrael v'haya li'eved le'eved olam. So Achish thinks, look at that. David is fighting a battle against the Jews. He really has turned on them. He is really my servant now. Now I trust David. So we have to ask two basic questions here. Number one, why is David attacking anybody? And number two, why these people in particular? So, why is David attacking anybody? Why isn't David just hiding from Shaul? What's his goal here? What would you say?
I think he was helping Shaul by getting rid of these people and clearing the land.
Good. So one way to read it, and we'll see a Radak who says it shortly, is that he's helping the Jews. He's helping Shaul along the way. By eliminating these people who were enemies of the Jews. That's one take. Yes, Ricky.
He wants to endear himself to the Pishtim, and then later he probably has a plan in mind to then use that against them.
So he definitely, and this is another view brought in Radak, needs to convince Achish that he's attacking the Jews. So someone's got to pay the price. That's another approach. Abarbanel brings a different idea. Take a look at source number 5, please. No, not number 5, sorry, that's from the 20-year thing. Number 6. Abarbanel says, Siper she'David va'anashav lo haya lahem le'echol. It's not as though they're getting support from Achish. They have to feed themselves. So David and his men attack these tribes in order to get food. And that's why they're going to the locals in order to be able to get food. That's Abarbanel's read of it. Radak disagrees. Radak doesn't make the comment here. Radak makes the comment in a different area altogether. Those of you who learned Malachim with me last year will remember the discussion we had about why David was not allowed to build the Beis HaMikdash. And one passage that we read said that it's because of innocent blood that he had spilled. And we wanted to know, which innocent blood are we talking about? What is that referring to? And Radak gave us multiple explanations, of which I brought two here. Take a look at source number 7. This is Radak on Divrei Hayamim, where you have that line about the spilling of blood. Uba Omro Damim Laro Shafachta Arza, when it says you spilled a lot of blood earthward. Kidam Nikiyim Haya Bidamim Asher Shafach Kamodam Urya. First of all, he says, because there were those David killed who were innocent, and he brings in Urya, the husband of Bathsheba, as an example. Gam Bidmea Kohanim Hayahu Hasiba, also the city of Nob. We talked about that last year and whether David is guilty there. David said he was guilty. Gam Bidmei HaGoyim Asher Shafach Osam. Also, though, the blood of the nations that he spilled in our story here. Shalayu Bnei Melchamto. They were not his enemies. They weren't fighting with him. Efshar Shayu Bahem Anashim Tovim V'chasidim. Maybe there were righteous people among them. Ava Pichei Lo Ne'en Ashalayim. However, the only thing is, David, you're not allowed to build the Beis HaMikdash. Hashem doesn't punish David for attacking them. Why doesn't Hashem punish David if it's wrong? Ki kavanaso lechalos harasha'im shelo yifritzu b'Yisrael. First explanation, because he viewed them as enemies of the Jews, people who are going to attack us. Amalek is among them. It's funny that we don't talk about it at all and say, hey, this is the mitzvah of mechias Amalek, of wiping out Amalek. Why doesn't anybody bring that as an approach to why David did it? I guess because he also has these other nations who are not Amalek. But that's one. And Ulatzi Alatzmok, Shayab Eretz Plishtim, to save himself when he's among the Philistines by convincing Achish that he's attacking the Jews. So David has justifications. But yes, he's going to suffer a result later on. Malbim similarly says, in terms of the idea that they're enemies of the Jews, Malbim says, when the text said they are Yoshvot Ha'aretz, they dwell in the land, it means that they're from the seven nations, who the Jews who were supposed to fight from the onset, either get them to accept the Noahide laws, or to fight them. So, David is fighting here, perhaps for survival in terms of food, perhaps for survival in terms of Achish, or perhaps for survival of the Jews as a whole, because these people are enemies of the nation. Those are your choices, either personal survival or national survival. But why these people in particular? What is it about these people? So the simple read is what Radak already said. They're enemies of the Jews. Or Radak has another idea, which he brings in source number 8. When the text says that they have been dwelling in the land forever, Radak says, the Hebrew is at the bottom of one side. Nope, I didn't translate the English on the other side. So I'll translate it now as I read it aloud. Sorry. Ki hine yoshvos ha'aretz asher me'olam. They were dwellers of the land forever. Perush, meaning, ki osan mishpachos shezachar. The families mentioned here, hayu yoshvos ba'osah ha'aretz mikedem lavetach. They dwelled in the land from before securely. Ad ba'ach ha'shur about Eretz Mitzrayim, geographically, until Shur, until Egypt. Ulefichach lo hayu nishmarim. Ki lo ha'isalem milchamayim adam. They didn't have defenses. Meaning, these are people who thought, we're just fine down here. There are no threats to us down here. And so they were vulnerable, and David was able to attack them easily. So your basic schools of thought are they're enemies of the Jews, or they're vulnerable. But then along comes Abarbanel, and Malbim may be with him. And Abarbanel floats a different idea altogether. Abarbanel looks at this whole story and says, I'm sorry, this whole thing is unrealistic. The whole thing is unrealistic. He says, are you going to tell me that David is going to really pull this off without Achish knowing anything? Come on. Now, keep in mind, he also believes it's 2 years and 4 months that this is dragging on, and Achish is just clueless about what's happening in the area. But even if it's not, even if it's not 2 years and 4 months, even if it's 4 months and a few days, you're just burning city, I mean not burning, but you're destroying the population, and just everybody just assumes you're fighting the Jews? Like, no one's investigating? Nothing? So Abarbanel says you have the story wrong. If you take a look at source number 9, which I did not translate, I liked having a one double-sided sheet. I remember back in the day when it always was. So I'm going to read it and translate it. He says, "V'hadavar hazeh zar etzli me'od." He says, this is really strange to me. He has a different problem first. Aside from the problem of, is Achish not going to find out? He says, if these are friends of Achish, right? If these are allies of Achish, are you seriously going to tell me that David, who has been taken in by Achish, is going to attack them? Lefishid begida rabba leDavid. This would be a terrible treason of David. Shlohakos anshei haaretz ulav ishes recho imahem, to strike the people of the land, right? Like, David's not going to do that, to start a fight with them. Vayamer gadol Achish melech haaretz asher asayim ocheset lahakos anashav v'yamo. He says this would be a grave rebellion against Achish, king of the land, who had helped David. He, now I'm going to go attack his friends. V'haya David bazeh im kein mishalem ra'a tachas tova. And David is then going to also be ungrateful. He's going to pay back the hospitality of Achish by attacking his friends. V'maya ozdeh pa'amim rabos. Then he comes back to my point. David is doing this many times. Right? As it says, he writes in parentheses that David did this as long as he was with the Plishtim. Im Cain, on the third line, Im Cain, Eich Nomar, Claudette, you're going to have to wait. I want everybody to hear this. Eich Nomar, Shaloya Mashir Ish V'Isha B'Mekomos Asher Hu Holech. How could it be that David would not leave anybody alive in all the areas he went? Are you really telling me there were no survivors? For real? Vukreb l'tiyach shar, it's impossible. You actually think you wiped out everybody? V'gamshi yimisem kulam, and if he is going to knock them all out, Eich Achish v'anashav lo matzuar tzosam shemama v'arahem sufos eish v'zarim ochlimosa. How did Achish and his men never dawned on them? They never traveled to the neighbors all this time? There was like a COVID lockdown? Like what? How did they never leave the house and see that their neighbor's cities were demolished? They knew, but they didn't investigate? Can't be. He says it's not possible at all. Etc. Bottom line of source number 9. It appears correct to me. Shahayu ha'umos ha'ele gishuri, grizi, or gizri, va'amalek, snuei nefesh achish, v'shem ha'yu oivav. The answer is, these tribes that were there were people who were at war with Achish. They're enemies of the Plishtim. That is your story. Malbim suggests, supporting this, that may be when it says they are Yoshvod Ha'aretz, they dwell in the land, they're neighbors and a source of trouble for the Philistines. And that's why Achish, I'm going to mute everybody. I want to make sure to get through this point. That's why Achish isn't going to mind what David is doing. And he notes, if you flip ahead to chapter 30, sentence 14, you're going to see there a man who is a servant to Amalek, and he describes how Amalek attacked the Kreti, and Abarbanel says the Kreti were allies of the Plishtim. I don't know where he gets that from. I don't remember where that's from. But he says the Kreti are allies of the Plishtim. So an Amalekite servant was attacking the Kreti, who are allies of the Plishtim. That supports the idea that the Plishtim and Amalek are not on the same page. It's also supported by the fact that we're going to see Achish go to war against Shaul and these people, Amalek, Gizri, all them, are not going to be joining him at all. But then you have to ask a question. And maybe this is what Claudette was going to ask. If you're telling me that these locals are enemies of the Philistines, why does David have to hide it from Achish? Why does he need to make sure there are no survivors to go tell Achish? To which the answer is, if they tell Achish, then he's going to know that David isn't attacking the Jews. David wants Achish to believe that he is attacking the Jews. So therefore, he needs the spoils from these people to show Achish. He doesn't want any survivors. And Abarbanel says, I believe that some must have escaped. But since they're enemies of Achish, they're not going to go running to him. They're assuming David is operating for Achish. So it's an entirely different way to read this. This passage here. So just to sum up what we're saying in this section then, what we're saying is that David, number one, is attacking for survival purposes. Either personal survival, food, as well as to trick Achish into thinking he's, loyal to the Philistines, or national survival because he wants to get rid of our foes. He attacks these people in particular, perhaps because they are enemies of the Jews, perhaps because they are vulnerable, and perhaps because they're enemies of the Plishtim. And therefore, if Achish does find out, he isn't going to mind that David was doing this, and they won't report to Achish, even if they do survive. Questions? Sandy?
By getting rid of them, my mind is gone. He also is not, imagine that in any country you've got allies with other countries or people who are married in from other tribes. So by getting rid of them, even if Achish would have been okay with it, any of the relatives who might have been wed to people there wouldn't go up against them and therefore say, how can you do this? Therefore, it's for public opinion, I suppose I'm trying to say. Just a thought.
Uh-huh. You mean there might be some of them among the Philistines? I suppose it's possible, yeah. Jeanette?
Sorry. Does anyone suggest, I really like Abarbanel's interpretation. It fits in so many ways. But I'm so uncomfortable with the idea of David killing innocent people just, for a shtick. Does anybody kind of combine those two ideas and say that these people were enemies of the Jewish people? Although, kind of as an added reason that he chose now to do it, was to win favor with Achish, because I'm just so uncomfortable with the idea of going from...
Right.
It just doesn't feel like David.
Right. The idea of David going to war like this and attacking them is difficult, and I think Radak is pointing to that by identifying it as the blood that he spilled. But keep in mind, and Abarbanel is really first and foremost in this regard, their view is this isn't shtick, this is survival. Right? Abarbanel felt it's literal survival. Like, he has 600 men and he has to feed them. Apparently farming wasn't a great option down in the Negev. So, this is what he comes up with, is Abarbanel's view. Or, alternatively, he needs to convince Achish, because where else is David gonna run at this point? That's the, that's another way to read it. I agree it's uncomfortable, and to a certain extent, I'm tempted to read it as part of an arc of the violence that's building in David's life. We talked about how Abigail kept him from attacking Nabal, and David was less bloody, for lack of a better word, in his approach to Shaul in chapter 26. But it could be that David becoming king is recognizing that, that is at this stage part of what he has to do. And I understand the discomfort for sure. Okay, I see a few hands. Janine, Ricky, and Etty.
First of all, for some reason in my mind, Gezer, there's some connection between Gezer and the Plishtim. Am I wrong?
I'm not thinking of one. That doesn't mean there isn't one. I'm not thinking of one. Unless you're thinking of Grar.
Well,
Gezer and the Plishtim?
But also, I think I remember in the time of Yehoshua that they were not able to capture Gezer.
Yes, that is correct.
So, again, and Amalek is an enemy, so that makes it a little better for Doug. I don't know who Geshur is, but...
All right, so Geshur we're coming back to. I'm going to talk about
Amalek and Gezer were both enemies. Israel had fought against...
Yeah. No, that is true. And Gezer, the only thing I'm remembering about Gezer, which you may be thinking of, is that when Shlomo marries the daughter of Paro, so Paro conquers Gezer and gives it to Shlomo as a gift.
And it doesn't say from whom he conquered it.
No, it was its own thing. They had a king. It was Melech Gezer, in Yehoshua, on the list of the 31 kings. I believe there's a king there. Okay.
Also, when they talk about innocent people, I think they're talking about the women and which in the Amalek wouldn't matter, but the women and the children. So again, Gezer was not, he didn't just attack some innocent nation, but the question is whether the women were.
Right. I mean, the children aren't mentioned, the women are mentioned though, it is true. Ricky, you were going to say, and then Etty.
First of all, thank you for bringing these commentaries. And thank you for not letting me ask questions, because all of these questions, how come, how could, and all of that, all what I was going to say. So
okay.
Thank you. You just brought it together so well.
Thank
my
you.
My question is, if David is fighting and he's giving the spoils to the Plishtim, and I assume that once these lands are, the Plishtim will move in, he's actually increasing the strength of the Plishtim. And I'm sure in the back of his mind, he wants to get rid of them. So how does it work in his plan?
Right, so I don't think he's moving the Plishtim in, because he's telling the Plishtim he's attacking other areas. He's not telling the Plishtim where he got the stuff.
He told
the Plishtim he got this from conquering the Jews. He didn't tell them that he got it from conquering Amalek and all these cities.
It doesn't matter, but these are areas that they can now occupy and increase their strength, and then eventually that could work.
Maybe. I suppose it's possible, although we don't find them expanding that direction. We usually look at them as expanding east. But maybe, I don't know, it's an interesting thought. I don't know. Etty.
I was
going
to say.
Okay.
It says somewhere, one of the commentators, I don't remember, said that he was attacking these places because he had to feed his men because they were hungry. But in another instance, he requested, I think it was from Naval, he requested food for his people. He didn't just attack them.
Right, but he requested help from Naval because he had been helping Naval for months and guarding his sheep. And by the way, he didn't get what he wanted. It took Abigail for him to get anything out of that deal.
But
so,
he could have asked these people for food, not just destroy them.
So this goes back to what Janine had said, and what I think the commentators noted, which is that they were not our friends, these people. They're not our friends. But I want to make sure, we only have about 10 minutes, 11 minutes, and I need to get through the rest of this chapter today, because I'm not holding off until after Sukkot. So I'm not going to push the point on that. Claudette?
With David going after the people in the area to get food, Sam is going there to get food, is also the fact that he doesn't want to rely on Achish to feed his men.
Yes.
So that he wouldn't be beholden to him when the time comes.
He's an immigrant. He doesn't want the host to say, you came here and, you know, you're on welfare in our society. You know, They want somebody who's self-sufficient. Yeah. Okay. Two notes on the people David is attacking. I am stunned that nobody asked me the first question. Who are the three tribes David attacked? Amalek, Geshur, and Gezri, or Grizi, right?
Wasn't Amalek supposed to have already been...
Yeah, you got rid of Amalek back in chapter 15. Especially if I'm going to take the view that Shaul is only king for 2 years, right? Like, what exactly happened? There was a medrash that said that Agag, because he was held over for one night, was able to get a woman pregnant that one night. So, you know, what was this, an army of a 6-month-old? What exactly was it that enabled David, that enabled Amalek to be even, to have a population? Where did they come from? So, when we learned chapter 15, I asked this question. when we talked about him wiping them all out, I just want to refresh your memory. In chapter 15, I suggested that there may have been multiple tribes of Amalek. I noted for you in source number 10 that in the book of Yahushua and Joshua, we get a list of 31 kings who Yahushua defeated. And Radak there says, that doesn't mean 31 kings of individual cities. There's this city with its king, this city with its king. Rather, each city that's mentioned is the head of a kingdom with more cities and villages. What that means is that there are many tribes associated with an individual tribal name. And it could be that there were multiple tribes of Amalek. And to me, that's the most logical read. I know that we do have sources that seem to say, yeah, if Shaul had not saved Agag, then we wouldn't have had to... I get it. Nonetheless, it's an awfully hard read, taking the extreme version of that. That's one approach. Alternatively, you could say what Abarbanel said here. Abarbanel said, who are you kidding? David didn't succeed in wiping out every last resident of the cities he was fighting. We actually saw Rashi back in chapter 15 who said the reason why they had to kill the animals was because there were people from Amalek who would disguise themselves as animals in order to flee. Well, since we know they didn't actually kill the animals, that would have given them an opportunity to get away. We also saw in the Dot Mikra edition, Professor Keel in source number 11 said the soldiers get involved in taking spoils. Therefore, they don't get everyone. But it's very clear, obviously, Amalek is still a thing. You can't say that Shaul got all but one of them. It's not feasible. It doesn't make any sense. But that's in terms of Amalek. The other is this Geshur we're talking about here. So there are two Geshurs, it appears. One Geshur is in Yahushua chapter 13, sentence 2. That's near the Philistines, the one we're talking about here. But also in chapter 13, sentence 11, there's a northeastern group of Geshur. They're also mentioned in Devarim chapter 3. There are two Geshurs. That's one thing to know. But the more salient point for us is that is an issue regarding the mother of Avshalom. Take a look, please, if you have a Tanakh with you. Shmuel Bet, chapter 3, sentence 3. Shmuel Bet, chapter 3, sentence 3. We are told of the family that David has when he is king in Hebron. For the first 7 years of his reign, he is king in Hebron. And we are told that his second son was Kilab, who was born to Abigail. And then the third son of David is Avshalom, famous Avshalom, son of Ma'acha, the daughter of Talmai, the king of Geshur. David marries the daughter of the king of Geshur, and his son from that relationship is none other than Avshalom. But it gets even better. Jump to, if you look at source number 12, you see the references there. Shmuel Bet, chapter 13, sentence 37. There is a falling out between David and Avshalom. This is before the rebellion. Avshalom runs away. You see where he goes? Va'avshalom barach, Avshalom fled. Vayelech el Talmai, he goes to Talmai ben Amihud, Melech Geshur. He runs back to his mother's family in Geshur. This is over the whole thing with Amnon, which we're not talking about right now. So Radak quotes a Medrash Tanchuma in source number 13. Basically what it says, because it's already 225, but what it says in this medrash that he quotes is that Avshalom's mother Ma'acha was what's called an Eshes Yefas Toar. Sandy, I saw your note. That's what I was referring to with the Rashi on chapter 15. The Avshalom's mother was an Eishes Yefas Toar. Remember the law of Eishes Yefas Toar. In the event that a male soldier in the battlefield sees a woman among this nation that they're fighting, then he is able to bring her back. She spends 30 days grieving the idolatry, assuming that she is willing to actually become Jewish, because you can't force a conversion, then he is able to take her as a wife. That's the Eishes Yefas Toar in a nutshell. There's an awful lot more to be said. But what Radak says, quoting the Medrash, is that Avshalom's mother, Ma'acha, is an Eishes Yefas Toar, and that explains why Avshalom rebels against his father. It's a product. You may remember the Medrash in the beginning of Parshas Ki Teitzei with the law of the Eishes Yefas Toar. It doesn't lead to good places. It's an extreme problem. So Radak says, when David goes to war against Geshur, he gets Ma'acha out of that war. She becomes his wife. From that comes Avshalom, who rebels against David. You follow? That's the idea. It's really interesting that the roots of what would be a major trauma in David's life are in this story, and they don't really get mentioned here. Like, there's no discussion of it in this story. But I think it's very interesting, particularly, as Jeanette pointed out, we're so troubled by what David is doing in general in this in these wars. Like, feeling like it comes back to bite him is I think, interesting. One other note. I have nothing I can do with this note, but I wanted to actually just mention it at least. And that is, Rav Bazak points out, when it says here, Yamim Arba'a Chodashim, which, again, we didn't know exactly how to read it, there's one other place that he found in Tanakh where it has a similar phrase. It's Pilegesh Begiva, the concubine at Giva. When she runs away from the man she was with and she goes back home at the beginning of the story, also, Yamim Arba'a Chodashim. I have no idea what the association would be. He has a thought, which I don't believe. I think he's incorrect, but I don't have a suggestion. So I'm just noting that. But what we have here is, overall, that David does not seem to be as vulnerable as we thought he was in the beginning of the chapter. Yes, he's desperate. He needs to get away from Shaul. Yes, he's relying for support on Achish, king of Gath. However, David also is coming in with strength, with a plan, and he's able to take advantage of his situation. Now, remember, we've said on other occasions that the Christian division of the chapters occasionally flies in the face of logic, and this is one of those cases. So take a fast look. We have a minute, but I have to show you, and then we'll just start after Sukkot with a review of chapter 27. That's just what we'll do. We'll start with the review questions. But look at the opening two sentences in chapter 28. Very quickly. It was in those days the Philistines gathered their armies for war against Israel. And Achish said to David, you know, you're going to come with me to war, you and your men. You're going to fight with me against the Jews. And David says to Achish, you know what your servant will do. Which is a very interesting way for him to frame it, because basically he's not saying anything by saying that. You know what your servant will do. And Achish says to David, I want you to be my bodyguard. Which means that David now does not need to fight against the Jews. So we're going to talk more about this and what's going on there. I had thought to do it today, but obviously we're not getting to that. So that'll have to be next time. I want to wish everybody a Ksiba v'chasima tova, a year of health, a year of bracha, a year of shalom, a year of nachas. Hashem should fulfill all of your tefillos for the best.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you.